Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Stephen Lee, who's also written under the name S.L. Farrell. He's published over 31 novels and nearly 60 pieces of short fiction. His current novel is Amid the Crowd of Stars, released by Daw Books on February 9th. Some of his other recent novels include A Rising Moon, A Fading Sun, The Crow of Connemara, and Immortal Muse. He's also a longtime contributor to the Wildcard series, edited by George R.R. Martin. Amid the Crowd of Stars is a bit of a departure for Stephen, particularly by design and partly fortuitously, if you will, by the times in which we live. An abandoned outpost on another world, a new species of human, so to speak, subject to the same weaknesses that we have on our planet, but resilient, brave, and industrious enough to survive and thrive, and coincidentally in a world with deep Irish roots. Thus, the allusions in the epigraphs and the chapter headings to William Butler Yeats and the structure of this new world and clans with a vocabulary that harkens back to these same Irish roots. The thrust of the book and our journey through it is science and science fiction, but we are moved more, I think, by relationships and the concept that no race and actually no two worlds can exist in isolation without a kind of tragedy. So welcome, Stephen, with that. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
So as I was saying, as a bookseller, I'm always interested in covers and epigraphs. And these are kind of unique. So, and I say so because when people come into the store, they look at covers, they look at epigraphs. So tell us a little bit about the cover and how much involvement you had in it.
Well, I did have a Sheila Gilbert, who's my editor at Dahl, generally works pretty closely with covers. I get drafts of the covers, and we look at what has been suggested by the artists. And so we went through three or four different covers, and that's the one we ended up with. We both liked a lot. We thought it was really striking.
Do you have it
by any chance? There. Oh, there
we go. Yeah, it has a, it kind of has two meanings. Yeah. It's kind of split down the middle.
That's the cover.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's excellent. So. Talk a little bit about the epigraphs, especially William Butler Yeats and how it differs from the third epigraph.
I love Yeats.
Obviously.
I've been to Ireland four or five times now. We have relatives over there. I've also taken, as a teacher, I've taken groups of students over there in the past. And it was actually on a trip to Ireland that I ended up on the Dingle Peninsula for a bit, which I thought was gorgeous. At the end of the Dingle Peninsula, there's a group of islands called the Blaskets. And I became fascinated with the Blasket Islands and their history. Ended up buying a lot of the books that were written by the inhabitants of the Blaskets. There's nobody living there now. They were all evacuated because there weren't many people left there in 1953. But it was an Irish speaking area of land. If at any point you wanted to learn Irish, that is one of the places you'd go to learn Irish. Very close-knit community. They're all fisher folk. And there was tension, cultural tension between the islanders and those people on the mainland of Ireland, which just because of the politics of that particular period. So I became fascinated by the Blaskets, read a lot about it, and decided at some point I'd probably write something about this. Now, this was in 2017. So COVID was still years in the future. It wasn't actually until I was actually writing the book, and because I started the book in 2018, finished it in 2020, and I realized that there was some tie-in to the idea of a plague or a pandemic. In fact, one of the novels for me always come from several different things. The Blasket Islands were a big spot of inspiration for me, but there was also the fact that at one point in time I was watching I was watching an old movie. I was watching Forbidden Planet, and I realized, and of course on Forbidden Planet, made when it was, you would see people, the Earth folk would go to a planet and they'd check the atmosphere, decide it was breathable. And as soon as they decided it was breathable, they just take their helmets off and start breathing, which of course means that they were breathing in all the bacteria and viruses that were there and breathing out all of the viruses that we had. So we were cross-infecting each other, which seemed like a really stupid idea to me. I mean, there's a reason why we sterilize all the spacecraft we send out, because we don't want to infect another planet with our stuff. So that was part of the inspiration for the book as well. I wasn't thinking of coronavirus at all at that point. It wasn't in my mind.
It reminds me when the Spanish arrived in South America.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Everyone died.
Absolutely. I remember reading an account of one of the Spanish explorers. I can't remember which one it was exactly, who at the mouth of the Mississippi came across a settlement of Native Americans, and he estimated that there were a few million people there. And then 20 years later, another Spanish explorer goes to the same spot, nothing, they're all gone.
Yeah, and that's
mostly because of smallpox.
You know, the other thing that was interesting about it, well, in addition to the epigraphs and your love of Yeats, is as much as the book was great, you also have really interesting things that go along with it. One, the map. Two, the dramatis personae, if you will. The glossary, the timekeeping method, the clans, and even in your acknowledgement and your research. And then at last, the comment that discusses COVID. So you went to a lot of time and trouble to go through setting the stage of this book. And I actually, luckily, I turned to the back first, which really gave me a help in reading the books with regard to the characters, reading the book with regard to the characters and the glossary of sorts.
Yes, I probably get a little too involved in world building at times. I love world building. And I can be somewhat obsessive about it. And because I put it all together, I feel like, well, you know, most of it doesn't show up in the book. I mean, you do a lot of research and you set a lot of things up, but they never have any reason to be in the book, so they're not in the book. But I always kind of throw those into appendices because I'm interested in them. So, I think maybe other people might be like, when I first read Tolkien, I was fascinated by the appendices in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and read them kind of obsessively. Whereas Denise, my wife, didn't read them at all because they weren't part of the book. They weren't part of the story.
Yeah.
But I was fascinated by them.
Well, it's funny because to kind of play devil's advocate with regard to the book, and I realize that, you know, each, when you get to first base, to first station, you have these people that survive. Why was it and how was it that over all these centuries, and we have a different method of timekeeping that we can talk about, centuries in one way, centuries in another way, how is it that the Irish language, the Irish culture, and all of those things survived?
Well, in my setup for this, I was figuring that when we sent these first ships out to make things easier, the Chinese would have sent a ship out, and everybody on that ship would have spoken Chinese. And, you know, the French might have sent a ship out, and everybody on that ship would have spoken French, because it's confusing. If you don't know the language of the people you're with, it's hard to communicate. So this particular ship that ended up on Canis Lupus was a ship that was sent out from the British Isles. And so there were Irish and Scots and Welsh and English on this ship. And so English was just the default language for everyone. So it, to my mind, it's not really an Irish world. It's an amalgamation of Irish, Scottish, Welsh. And I kind of borrowed from all of those languages for slang and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I have notes for slang and that.
Yeah, you do. And that's great. I really enjoyed that. You know, and the funny thing is, you know, well, since we're trying to sell the book, the characters are so well drawn. And it's, again, good that you list the characters and the cast, so to speak, in the back, because even though there are 2 to 3, maybe 4 primary characters, there's so many well-drawn peripheral ones. But if we want to talk about them, perhaps the two most important, and if I'm pronouncing them right, is Ishiko or Ishiko?
I also study Aikido, so I'm relatively familiar with Japanese, relatively language. There's not a lot of, we stress everything with syllables. There's very little syllabic stress on things. So, for instance, the head of the USAF, the United States Aikido Federation, is Yoshimitsu Yamada, which we always, being Americans, we would say his name is Yamada, because we put stresses on syllables. But if you listen to him say his name, Yamada, it's very flat. So Ichiko is more flat.
Ichiko. Okay.
Ichiko.
What about Cersei? Or is it like in Game of Thrones?
Saoirse. Irish pronunciation. Oh my God. I don't speak Irish or Scots. Or Gaelic in any form. I can pronounce some of the words, but I know a scattering of the language, but I don't speak it in any strong sense. But yeah, the pronunciation of Irish is really bizarre sometimes. They don't have a They don't have like there's there's a there's a first name for a female in Irish that is M-H-A-I-R-E, which we would probably say mare or something like that. And but there's no M-H is actually a different, it changes the pronunciation of the consonant, the vowels that come after the pronunciation change. So M-H-A-I-R-E is Wyra. M-H is pronounced as a W.
Oh, so more, it's like, more or less. It's like Siobhan.
Yeah, you got it. So yeah, that's why I tend to put the pronunciation in there if I can, just because it's bound to be different.
Okay. Well, so since we are trying to sell the book, and since it's in the front table of our bookstore and in the window, why don't you just go backwards and let's just talk a little bit about a summary of the plot and what's going on here and why it's going on.
Yeah. Basically this is one of the standards for science fiction is what's called a first contact story, where it's the first contact with an alien race, right? That's a pretty. I've done first contact novels actually in my past. A ship they called the Dunbrody went out from the British Isles, landed on Canis Lupus. And then there was a problem back on Earth, and so they left. And basically, what I was hypothesizing is a meteor hit, a fairly large meteor hit the Earth, and basically set us backwards for a while. So there was no follow-up. The Dunbrody left and did not return in Earth time for a couple hundred years. And what happened, of course, on all the people from Earth were on a, there were two bases there. One didn't last at all, but the base in the hemisphere I was in, called First Base, of course, over time, nothing could be because they didn't have any supplies down. And eventually technology broke down in first base and they had no choice. They had to expose themselves to Canis Lupus's atmosphere and all the viruses and all the other things that were there. So a great many of them died who had been there. Hang on.
That's right.
Get rid of that. Where was I? Oh yeah, a great many of the people on first base died because they picked up Canis Lupus diseases that were transmitted to them, and of course at the same time they're kind of infected the world with our viruses, that's the basic setup. And then we now have a ship coming back to Canis Lupus from Earth. Now it is a multinational because they have the technology to, you know, basically everybody has a chip in their head that can translate different languages. So you don't have to worry about everybody being able to speak the language. It's called an AMI, A-M-I, Autonomous Metronic Interface. That's the setup for the book is we're coming back to this place where we have left people. And they've actually started to thrive. They've actually have several hundred people a few thousand people at this point, from people reproducing over these 200, 300 years. And some of them come back to Earth. And what the ship is there to find out is, can we take back to Earth? You know, or are they so infected by the biota of Canis lupus that we really can't safely take them back? And that's a... Did that come across?
Yeah. And
okay.
And the interesting thing is that you have two factions on this new world, one that's slightly more technologically advanced, and the second one that prefers to live the old way. And it's the interface between the two of those that really inform the book in a lot. Well, without giving spoilers away, and a third one. So. That's the good setup. And then also, as I was saying, in terms of the characters, oh yeah, it's interesting. In the book, you have like two semi-love stories that may not really be love stories necessarily.
Right.
And there's this allusion throughout to sex. There's a lot about sexuality. There's an allusion or two about sex itself. There is no sex actually in the book. But it's interesting the way the two relationships evolve. It's a well-drawn love story within all of this too.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I'm more fascinated by characters than science.
Obviously.
And what I like is especially like to examine is cultural conflict. So there's cultural conflict in this one between the people who have come from Earth and the people who were left there. So there's that conflict. There's the conflict between the islanders and the Inish, as I call them, and the mainlanders here, which is a reflection actually of the Blasket Islands again. So the Inish are basically the Blasket Islanders, and the other people are the mainlanders. And then there's, of course, another race here, an intelligent race here that we may not, that is there. And that's another cultural conflict. And then there's actually a different race that is another conflict. And I said, that's what fascinates me is the idea of cultural conflict. You know, when two cultures meet and just clash.
Yeah, it's really weird because you got the culture of the ship, the culture of the mainlanders, the culture of the outlying islands, and then you have that other one, then you have the other one, and then you have the Amis who... It's really funny how hers is acting up right at the very beginning, you know? Why? It's like it's a premonition kind of, because, you know, when she's pushing and the light doesn't go off, I'm not trying to give anything away here, but.
It's because there's already been some cross infection. But it's foreshadowing, you know, basically, is the fact that Ichigo's Ami is acting up already. It does foreshadow what happens later on.
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff I can't give away, but I would like to talk about it. But I wouldn't do that to you. And the reviews haven't either. So the idea of these out. Let's see. How can we get there without getting there?
Good luck.
What about the putative? Well, I'll talk about the biosuits that prevent the each from touching the other, because that's what someone wants to do. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I had to have a way for the people coming from Earth to not be infected, because they want to go back, you know, to Earth, but they can't if they're infected with stuff here. So hence the bio suits, which basically just, you can't touch anything. It's like there's this little invisible barrier that will stop you from actually touching something. You can't eat anything there. You know, none of the people coming from Earth can eat anything there. They're entirely dependent on the food stores they have on the ship. They can't breathe the air, so they're kind of sheltered from that as well. If one of their biosuits would fail, they'd be stuck. They could not go back. Which is another issue for them.
Yeah, so, and again, I can't talk about it. But it is funny. Yeah, and it's funny the way you emphasize the olfactory aspect of the fact, because they can't smell anything either.
No, you can't breathe the air, you can't smell.
She misses the idea of real food. And she misses the idea of the smell of the quay, the salt water, the fish, and all of that. And that really comes across really well, because normally I wouldn't think about that on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, it's like all of a sudden, if the birds stop chirping, you know, it's like you're missing a great deal.
Yeah, Ichiko, of course, came from a Japanese coastal village. So she used to, in fact, she and Saoirse at some point talk about, you know, because Saoirse asked her, what did your village smell like? And she talks about what it smelled like there. And of course, she can't smell what it smells like here, because she's not allowed to smell. You know, the biosuit prevents her from actually smelling anything. So that bothers her.
Yeah. And also, it also interferes with the possibility of a physical relationship in a certain way, which I really wanted to happen. And that's another thing. You were trying to do that, and it really worked, because I'm wanting that to be something, especially since the Luciano thing is like, yeah, yeah.
Not a good match.
No. Well, first you think, okay, well, because at first she's kind of like disses it herself, but it couldn't have worked. But the other, Saoirse and Ichiko, obviously could. And
Saoirse definitely wants it to work.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the other thing that's really interesting, is there's no pejorative or judgmental, maybe a little bit, especially from her brother. But there's no judgmental aspect of the bisexuality or pansexuality that these people have by necessity.
Right. I've done this in a couple books now, which is, it has never made sense that we follow patrilinear lineage. In other words, in our society, largely in Western society, we follow the father's lineage. We use the father's, you know, the wife often takes the father's name. So, you know, your family name is often, still often, less so now, but still very much usually your father's family name. Makes no sense to me. You always know who your mom is because you came out of her. You don't necessarily ever know who your father actually is.
Yep.
So it makes sense to me that you should follow the matrilinear line, because you always know who your mom is, which is why all the clans have the name of the female who founded them, not the name of the male who founded them. Or the surname of the female who founded them.
Yeah, it's like when they're on the boat going back, they're saying, we have to ask your mother whether this is, and at first it's not that it's off-putting, it's just, oh, that why do they have to ask her? And then she has to make the decision about whether the flitter can come out to the island or not. And mm-hmm. it's her decision. And at first you go, well, that seems kind of odd, but then it immediately becomes obvious just in the way you explained it.
Yeah. Who knows who your dad is?
Yeah, and I didn't think about that either until I realized, yeah, all he has to do is one thing and then he's gone. And yeah.
Sometimes that's all he does.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the idea in the book is that this idea of consciousness, which in this book touches upon the entire ecological aspect of the world they live in. As I said, you could call it fortuitously, but it does. And I realize that you didn't have this in mind at the time, but it really does reflect our past year, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I said, as I was doing revisions on the book, at that point, I was going, oh, this is like our world now. And it wasn't intentional on my part. I'd love to say I realized this was going to happen. I didn't. It's just kind of coincidental that it happens to match up with what was going on in especially 2020.
Yeah.
Which is why I felt the need to at least acknowledge that, the linkage between COVID and this novel, even though it wasn't intentional. It just showed up.
Yeah, it's weird. Well, it's funny, I was talking about the peripheral aspects of this book, like the characters and order of appearance, which was great, or the glossary. And the other thing was when you were talking about how much you love Yeats, and then two of the first epigraph is his, the second's a proverb. But it's also interesting how you name the chapters and how appropriate the names of those chapters are. So you must, I was wondering about that. How did you accomplish that? Yeah. You must have been reading a great deal of Yeats as you wrote this book. You had to be.
I have a complete Yeats book. Everything he's ever written. As I said, as a poet, I love his language as a poet. So I just looked up a lot of the quotes. Not all of the chapter titles are Yeats. Some of them are me.
No.
But most of them are snippets of Yeats. Sometimes changed a little, like Amid the Crowd of Stars, the title of the book, is from a Yeats poem. But although in the Yeats it's Amid a Crowd of Stars, I just preferred the rather than an. But that's a Yeats quote as well.
Without me spoiling it and letting you spoil it if you want, how much do you want to talk about? I mean, there's so many aspects of this book, different ways you could come at it, but do you want to talk at all about the nature of consciousness and how small it can appear to be on our planet, where I don't even know if you exist or we are conscious? I could be living in a solipsistic universe, whereas there, things expand outward. Why don't you talk about your philosophical aspect of that and how it's appeared in your writings in the past, or why you feel that there's this potential or possibility, or maybe you believe it actually exists, of that kind of expanding consciousness?
Yeah, I'm not sure that, I mean, I've read a lot of, I'm not a religious person, but I'm fascinated by religion. Because it has formed, I don't think there's been a human society where religion of one form or another is not at the core of it. And I'm just fascinated by religion. I've read pretty much every sacred book out there, from Hindu to Buddhist to mythologies to, I've read them all. And so I'm fascinated by the idea of what else is out there? But as I said, I'm not religious myself. I don't know what's out there. Maybe I'll find out one day, but I won't be back to tell anyone.
Who knows?
But I'm, if there are, there are so many worlds, but, and we're finding more and more worlds out there every day. There are tons and tons and tons and tons of worlds out there where life could have evolved. And who knows how it evolved and who knows what it's like there. You know, I kind of suspect that we would, we may not even recognize life, sentient life, on another world, because it's just too alien from ours. And maybe we would just miss it entirely.
Well, or like here, where the first thing that these entities say is, don't tell them about us. And, you know, it's like, we could miss it because they simply do not want to be recognized because we're such a nuisance. We're like, we're like mosquitoes.
the Cinna,
right,
a different type of entity entirely, and they kind of operate as a almost a compiler of various species. So I don't examine them much there. I leave that pretty much to the imagination of the reader. But there are so many worlds out there that there has to be stuff out there that we can't even imagine at this point, and would be, you know, useless to even. I have the fear that even if I came up with the strangest thing in the world for a different race, that I'd be off by a mile.
Right.
And there's something even more strange out there. So
I like the idea that you talk about a compiler, because it doesn't really convey any value judgment at all. It's almost like a librarian. And what the Cinna do is they just, as they do with the Amis, is just incorporate them. And yeah, they incorporate them. And the other thing that brings to mind is, because of that, you leave the book in the way I like books left, where the reader has to wonder what is going to happen next, which leads, as it could, to a possible sequel. And
maybe, but I really prefer. I mean, I have committed sequels before,
yep.
In the past, but actually, most of my books recently have been standalone, and I tend to prefer that. I did a series for Dahl, a trilogy for Dahl, a fantasy trilogy,
right.
Called the Cloud Mages trilogy. And I really liked it, but I had this bigger idea of, you know, because in that particular universe, magic comes and goes and in waves. And I wanted, and these waves take place over a century or more. And I wanted to follow from a peak to a trial back to a peak. And I figured it would take me 12 books to do that. So the first trilogy just follows it from a trial up to a peak. And that's it, and stops. And I was going to follow it along to another trial and another peak. But you know what? By the time I'd done three books in that world,
you had enough.
I was kind of tired of that world, and I wanted to do something different.
The thing about this one is that it's almost like the Foundation series, or Red Mars, Blue Mars, Green Mars, in that... let's see, how can I say this? At the end, with regard to Odysseus, the mothership, and what happens there, and with regard to the relationship that I love so much, I'm left, you've left me in the middle of things, and I don't mind. No, I think it's great because, again, owning a bookstore, there's two kinds of people. There's one kind of person that likes the book all tied up at the end, and that's fine. But there's another person that wants to be left, not in the dark, but left wondering and maybe figuring it out in their own head what they'd like to see happen or wanting more. And those are the kind of books I like.
Well, I've done, believe it or not, comedy a bit and juggling and I've been on stage playing music and that. And the adage there is you always want to leave the audience wanting more. You never want to tie it all up because then why would they come back?
Exactly.
I like assuming that my readers are intelligent people who can take the hints that I have given and make up their own mind as to what happens afterward. So I always leave a few threads not tied up yet for them to figure out on their own. And who's to say they're right and I'd be right and their way of tying it up isn't better than mine. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the cool thing about you is that you've written so many books that sometimes I'll ask an author if it's their first book or a special book, do they feel like they're letting their firstborn go out into the world? But you've written so many that I don't think you must have that feeling. You just let them go and that's it, right? You're not tied to them in any particular way, are you? Or are you?
No, in fact, I'm in the middle of another book now. Which is not a sequel, but will be another standalone book. I have moved on from Amid. I really like Amid. I think it's, I enjoyed writing it. I had a great time with it. I really like the way it's turned out. And I hope a lot of people read it, I'm in the middle of another book and my mind's there now, not back here.
Well, I guess like in conclusion, what I would say would be the reason why when I've sold the book in the bookstore is that there really are so many themes. Yeah, I can think of like six different themes. And then you couple that with the relationships, the personal relationships, which you say you feel are more important anyway, that there's so much going on in this book, but it's not hard to keep track of it. And then again, you help out at the end. So what I think, like, I guess I would thank you for is writing a book where not only can the reader spend some time thinking, but the entertainment, if you will, is multifaceted.
Well, thank you for that. That's what I'd like to try to do. As I said, I'm far more, every book I've written it has been, to me at least, relationship-based. You know, it's the characters and their interrelationships that fascinate me. The world fascinates me too, but it's the characters in the world that make a difference. To me, that when I read a book, that's what I remember, is not so much how well built was this world, but you know, were the characters good? Do I believe the characters? Am I interested in the characters? Because to me, if you're not interested in the characters, you're not going to read the book.
No.
Why would if I'm not interested in the characters, I put the book aside. You know, I've done that many times.
And that's why I said, I mean, I know there's tons of characters, but there are two at the end that I'm hoping the best for them. And I'm hoping they'll live happily ever after. And that's a really good way to end it. And I guess this interview too. And thanks so much for joining us. And I hope to see you again, perhaps when the next book is finished.
Okay, that'd be great. I'll look forward to it. Likewise. Enjoyed our conversation. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
See ya.
See ya.